This is the Voice of Freedom.
This is my happening and it freaks me out.
Never before since Jamestown and Plymouth Rock has our American civilization been in such danger as now.
In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
Jesus was black, Ronald Reagan was the devil, and the government is lying about 9/11.
The government, they the biggest monster. That's what we study. Governments.
Everybody's scared of the government, you know what I'm saying?
Politics is nothing but war without bloodshed, and war is nothing but politics with bloodshed.
Like 1984.
Does it look like stable thoughts go through my mind?
God damn America!
Having that dream where you made the white people riot, weren't you? How many times have I told you you better not even dream about telling white folks the truth?
We need to open our eyes. Our government doesn't give a shit.
This is about your life and mine. We're losing our freedom. And this isn't something that's going on far away. This isn't something that's happening places we can't do anything about it. It's happening right here.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brother.
The enemy should be in no doubt that we are his nemesis and we are bringing about his rightful destruction.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
We're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House!
Thank you for your time and good night.
What is the haps, Hep Cadets, Cats, and Kittens? It's your host, Moxie O'Brien, back again with another episode of Come and See here on another Friday morning in America. This is my happening, and it freaks me fucking out. So I'm still dealing with some of the health visual, you know, Apostle Paul blindness issues, which is why I'm kind of shooting from the hip quite a bit on today's episode. But fortunately, this is an episode that I can kind of get away with doing that. But I'll get into that in a few minutes. This is actually an appropriate lead into that, I think. So every once in a while, I do clerical related things for the show, and I was doing some work on checking emails and things of that nature. By the way, the delay on the t-shirts is due to the printer having COVID. Those are, as I've been told, finished and about to be mailed to me. And once they're mailed to me, I can mail them to you. I apologize for the delay. Capitalism's fucked. And also COVID's fucked. Which is another thing that's happening in our world. I don't know how to end that sentence. Anyway, so I was checking email, and I hadn't checked the old email, which is linked to a lot of stuff for this show still, because, as some of you are aware, the old show, The Four Cornered Room, kind of ended and became this show in a manner of speaking. I don't know if it's fair to say it became this show, but aesthetically there's some similarities because most of the aesthetics were coming from me. But there is one video on YouTube from the three seasons, I believe, we did of The Four Cornered Room. It's an interview that we/I did with Dan Friesen of Knowledge Fight. Those of you who are familiar with the Knowledge Fight podcast, they cover Alex Jones and some other conspiracy theory weirdos and pseudo-scientific people. It's adjacent to what I do over here, I guess. And towards the end of The Four Cornered Room, I think the subject matter that I was leaning into was mirroring what this was going to turn into. So I tried to get Dan on the show, and some fucking how he got back to me and agreed to do the show. It was a lovely interview. I do recommend, if you want to look that up on YouTube, that is out there. It's also on Spotify, but don't look it up on Spotify. They don't pay me for that. Anyway, so I had someone start following the old Four Cornered Room page, looking for more Four Cornered Room content, and I sent them a message and let them know that that show doesn't exist anymore, but that this was a thing and you could come over here. And I was thinking about how, in some ways, perhaps, this show has kind of, over the span of, it's only been a year, but we're fast approaching 100 episodes, some fucking hell, because I don't know when to not work. But it's maybe gotten away from the original concept a bit, but not that that's a bad thing necessarily. I don't know that the original concept was fully developed so much as, what if I got real stoned and talked about the conspiracy shit I was into whenever I was a kid? That could be something. Maybe people would listen to that, and it wouldn't be me talking about historical black tragedy and trauma every goddamn day. So that's really the origin point for Come and See at the Root of Things. That, and what if there was a black militant leftist hour of the time, which is kind of what this has turned into in a lot of ways, I think. But that aside, I was thinking about the first several episodes of this show, many of which I have trouble listening to because the audio quality is fucking garbage. But the first season, which I now refer to as the pilot season, mostly for that reason, has an episode, I think it's in the first five or six episodes of the show, where I sort of went over a conspiracy theory of my own. That was that Charles Manson was very probably either an actor on behalf of a plant of the CIA or the result of the MK Ultra program, one of those. And I kind of spent, I don't know, 70 or 80 minutes outlining why I had that theory, going through some of the different aspects of MK Ultra, which is also why I didn't do MK Ultra this week. I realized I've already talked about it for 45 fucking minutes and I didn't need to. But I sort of outlined how I think Charles Manson was probably a plant by the CIA to sabotage the California hippie movement and end the 1960s free love, that kind of a thing, movement by demonizing hippies to the general public and also creating a rift between hippies and like radical black left movements of the 1960s and going into the 1970s. Not that that was difficult to do. A lot of hippies did that just by virtue of being hippies. But that I thought Charles Manson was in many ways aimed at like the burgeoning California left. And today, we're going to talk about a similar conspiracy theory of mine that involves Jim Jones and the People's Temple. I think that a lot of people think they know the story of Jim Jones and the People's Temple, but I find that when you start talking to people about Jim Jones and the People's Temple, there's a lot about that story most people are not aware of beyond the mass suicide in Guyana, which, much like the Tate LaBianca murders and the Charles Manson episode that I did in the pilot season, the mass suicide slash mass murder, depending on what side of the conspiracy coin you land on, isn't actually a prominent part of today's episode. I tend to, even when I'm dealing with things that are true crime or true crime adjacent, not get into, you know, salacious and lurid details about people dying and shit, because that's not really what I do, and I think it's gross and unnecessary. So we're going to talk about a conspiracy related to that at some point today, but the majority of the episode is going to deal with Jim Jones himself, his relationship to radical black left and communist movements of the time, and all of the apparent evidence that Jim Jones, much like Charles Manson, was aimed at the California left of the 1960s and 70s. But there's also the possibility that, similar to Huey Newton, he was fed drugs to drive him insane so that he would tank his own organization and therefore put a black spot on the politicians and political movements that he was affiliated with. It's really questionable how much of this, I think, was Jim and how much of it, I think, was the intelligence community. I also do want to preface this the same way that I did with the Charlie Manson episode and say that I'm not saying I think Jim Jones is a good guy. In no way whatsoever do I believe that Jim Jones was a good person. I think that, to some extent, Jim was an instrument of the FBI and the CIA in their broader war on the American radical left of the 60s and 70s. And there are multiple examples of people throughout American history that I think fall into this category. On our next episode, we're going to talk about how I think the CIA may have some sort of a Manchurian candidate relationship with a lot of American serial killers. But there's I think, sufficient evidence that Jim Jones wasn't acting alone, especially whenever you get into, you know, one of the things we touched on the Manson episode was how a guy from rural Ohio who couldn't read learned CIA mind control techniques. And in much the same way, Jim Jones is a kid from rural Indiana who knew how to functionally manipulate people into joining a political organization masquerading as a church. And the political aspirations were always there too. We'll get into that as well. But there's a lot of angles we have to look at today. So I'm going to wrap up this the opening statements and get into the material. So here we go. Now, the commonly accepted story about Jim Jones is that a white guy from rural Indiana started a cult, they moved to Guyana, and committed mass suicide after murdering a visiting politician. And to an extent, that is what happened, but it's also probably not actually what happened. Jim Jones founded the People's Temple in Indianapolis, Indiana, in 1955. And while Jones was stylized very much as a sort of charismatic Pentecostal minister, the predominant and prevailing message was always communism. Jones actually frequently criticized the Bible, especially in his early sermons, going so far as to call himself the socialist worker god and talk about the futility of the American sky daddy and throw the Bible on the ground and jump up and down on it. He also preached that Jesus was a communist and that the early church was founded on communist ideals. And you really could make a pretty strong argument for both of those things if you wanted to. Communal Christianity has existed since, like, I think the 3rd or 4th century or something like that. So there's a lot of evidence to back up the idea that there are communalist or communist roots in the early Christian church. I mean, there was an abolition of private property, a dedication to public service. They lived in fucking communes, a general abolition of a hierarchical leadership structure until everybody decided that Peter was the Pope, those kinds of things. So there is a precedent for the idea that Christianity and communism have similar roots, I guess, if you wanted to put it that way. Much of Jones's preaching style and overall persona was actually mimicked from a black minister named Father Divine, who was the founder of the International Peace Mission. fully named the Reverend Major Jealous Divine, the Messenger, Father Divine claimed to be the incarnation of God, who was immortal and fulfilled all previous biblical prophecy. Divine is considered part of the New Thought movement that we discussed in Season 2. He preached a sort of decentralized communal divinity in that he was God, but he, God, was also in everyone and everything else. And therefore, things like shared consciousness and a lack of hierarchy outside of Divine himself, who is just a bit more God than everybody else was. Divine had ideas about race that were very similar to Bill Cooper, in that he believed that there were no black or white Americans, just Americans. And, you know, whatever, this is America, you're free to be wrong. It's one of the few guaranteed freedoms that we still have here, actually. But despite this, Divine still campaigned heavily against lynch mobs, and thus developed an extremely large black congregation over time. The Peace Mission also practiced communal living. Divine was generally popular with the government because he made all of his members refuse government assistance and pushed for black self-sufficiency. Reportedly, he saved the city of New York $2 million in welfare and Social Security payments during the Great Depression. They also refused to use credit, something that allowed the group to flourish throughout the Depression. Their entire community dealt only in cash, so when the bottom fell out of the credit system, there was a lot of really rich black people affiliated with this church who only did business with each other. Divine's a really interesting cat. To date, no one knows what his real name was. The one that was dug up by reporters doesn't match any records in the Library of Congress, and his FBI file was listed under George Baker, aka God. He claimed no parentage or familial relations, saying only, quote, God has no mother, and refused offers for a biography or autobiography, saying, quote, the history of God wouldn't be useful in mortal terms. We think his mother may have been a former slave from Rockville, Maryland, named Nancy Baker, but there's no real consensus about Divine's life, his family, his age, or his name prior to him just kind of appearing and saying that he was God incarnate sent to show people how to achieve immortality by ascending to godhood. Divine moved his church to Harlem in the 1930s as international branches opened in Switzerland, France, Australia, and Canada. Divine's church numbered almost 2 million at its peak, and in 1934, Divine's Peace Movement Church partnered with the Communist Party of America, and Divine's message became gradually more political. He had a fairly well-publicized feud with William Randolph Hearst, actually, who used his newspaper empire to criticize Divine and his communist church. Divine had pretty continuous legal problems, as you'd expect, as well as accusations that he maintained control over his members' finances to keep a rich lifestyle and coerced female members into sex while discouraging sex marriage, or even fraternizing between men and women in the group. Divine's denial that he was black also alienated membership over time, and as his congregation was in a state of flux, Father Divine met Jim Jones. Now, whether Jones was always a manipulative person feels questionable. I think an argument could be made that his insertion into Father Divine's black, communist, religio-pseudo-cult may have been intentional on the part of the federal government. To be sure, Jones's rhetoric mirrored Devine's almost entirely, and when Devine died on September 10th, 1965, funny, I thought he was immortal. Jim Jones claimed that Devine's spirit had entered his body and anointed him God and the new harbinger of Devine's message. Honestly, the extent to which Jim Jones took the idea that he was spiritually black is fucking jaw-dropping. When discussing the plight of freed slaves in the civil rights movement, Jones often referred to us and we, and on more than one occasion called himself God's own nigger while chastising white members of his congregation. And, okay, some of that could have been the meth, which we're going to get into later, but it's dubious. So was how he used race within the hierarchical structure of his own church, but we'll get into that in a bit. Jones's own temple doctrine was based heavily on Devine's international peace movement and preached communal living, abolition of private possessions, and a broadly pro-black civil rights message. The People's Temple also boasted membership from several black Cuban immigrants on loan from Castro to help further spread the ideas of socialism and pro-Cuban sympathy through Jones, whose proximity to Devine rubbed off quite a few followers. Incidentally, Devine was also Jones's inspiration for recording himself all the time, something that would, one could say, come back to bite him later on in life. Jones himself identified as a Marxist from a very young age, according to him anyway, and he joined the clergy during the Red Scare as a means to dispensate communist ideas without arousing suspicion. While not himself Pentecostal, he adopted their ideas of speaking in tongues, catching spirits as part of his act, let's call it, to appeal to what he saw as a large black audience. Jones also performed staged healings, doing what were essentially old carny tricks, like using chicken livers to affect the idea that he'd pulled cancer out of people, and healing elderly members' Alzheimer's, which were usually not actually elderly members. They were some of the young college-aged white women that Jones was sleeping with in the group, dressed up like old women, who would then pretend to be healed. That's a very interesting aspect of the People's Temple to me, that members of the group have admitted to helping Jones fake his miracle cures to obtain more members and grow the size of the temple. So you knew when you were in the group that the things he was telling people about his miraculous superpowers were fake because you were helping him perpetrate that idea to other people, but you still thought he was genuine enough to attract more followers. I mean, I understand that there's an aspect of brainwashing and conditioning involved in cult psychology, which is one of the things we're going to get into in today's episode, but it's sort of baffling to me that this guy had convinced everyone in his group that he needed their help to fake the fact that he had powers because he really had powers and they needed to grow the size of the church because his message needed to spread. He also had a sort of proto-John Edwards gimmick where his people would do something called garbage raids. So he would send, again, white college-aged women into black neighborhoods in blackface, in a lot of cases, to raid people's garbage cans for information that they would then collect on note cards and give to him so that when these people came to the church, Jones could affect the idea that he had a preternatural ability to know things about people he shouldn't have known. And it was because he had a 19-year-old white girl from Orange County digging through your trash at 3 a.m. to go through your pill bottles and shit like that. It's a fascinating the extent to which Jones used this cadre of young white women to control a predominantly black congregation is in and of itself fascinating, and the criticism of this behavior began very, very early in the history of the church. There is references to members leaving the church at the realization that it was a white guy using white women to control black people to take money from them as early as like 1963 for a church that started in 1955. So this was a persistent accusation against Jones and the People's Temple. And these cards were then, like I said, given to Jones so that he could come across like a prophet with supernatural powers who would know people's names, addresses, in some cases banking and medical information, all kinds of things to give the impression that he was a super powerful, supernatural being, the socialist worker god. By the 1960s, the People's Temple membership was more than 60% black, and through a temple soup kitchen, a job placement program, a free coal program in the wintertime, clothing banks, and general social outreach, the group was feeding and serving 2,000 plus black people per month, many of whom ended up joining the church. Jones blended Marx with Acts 4, 34, and 35, for example. Here's that for you. Quote, distribution was made to each as any had need, which is fairly easily married to from each according to his abilities to each according to his needs. And Jones would use this sort of rhetoric to compel members to staff growing social ventures and then pay them no wages, allowing the organization to grow considerably with almost no overhead. He also poached membership from other black churches, accusing their pastors of fleecing membership using the opiate of the people. You know, the thing he was doing. Jim called it apostolic social justice, a melding of, or more appropriately, the use of the Bible and Christianity as a delivery system for Marxism. Arguably, Jim's goals were always more political than spiritual, and his ties to political figures such as, you know, the current head of the John Birch Society, Walter Heddy, makes some of his claims about Marxism rather questionable. They also make the anti-communism of the John Birch Society a little bit questionable in the process, but grifters don't actually believe anything. As I touched on a second ago, despite being predominantly black, the People's Temple had no black leadership. Directly attending Jones himself and in charge of temple discipline was a group of attractive college-age white women who were all fucking Jones. And this, of course, creates an interesting power structure within the temple itself, where you have an almost entirely black working body, and then a group of white, let's call them women of the house, who chastise, manipulate, fine, and beat all of the black workers on behalf of the white slave master, or Jones, who sleeps with the white women to maintain a level of dominance over them and permits them access to aspects of himself not seen by other members of the group, but also allows him to avoid being associated with any negative feelings from the majority of the congregation, because none of the negative treatment came from him until everybody was quite locked the fuck in several years down the road. But for the introductory period, it's actually interesting how much this mirrors pimp psychology, honestly. We talked about this a little bit with Charles Manson and the Manson girls, but it's true of a lot of cults and really a lot of CIA mind manipulation tactics, that there is the same sort of psychological manipulation tactics that pimps use is how a lot of men start cults, because quite frankly, cults are just sex groups, like they're just harems for really, really gross dudes. So there's a level of breaking down the identity and the self of these women to input your own personality, your own ideas, yourself, where they used to be. And then you manipulate them with sex, emotional abuse, and if you can get that far with it, physical abuse. And then you use them to manipulate the people that are under them. It also creates an invisible barrier between yourself and the majority of the group, because everyone perceives that there is this go-between they have to approach in order to get to you. It gives you the illusion of being unattainable. And while we're talking about how this is pimp shit, a lot of you have probably thought about the fact that this sounds exactly like how management structure works in most corporate jobs. Funny that. Perhaps that tells you something about how you're perceived by the people you work for. Maybe. Whatever. I'll go on. Jones also used Marxist theory and ideas like self-crit to create shaming rituals. These were situations where he would take the person that he wished to discipline and place them in a circle surrounded by their closest friends in the temple, who would then shout their grievances, tell them about their shortcomings, and in some cases, physically attack them. He also required members donate all money and possessions and dress in plain clothes and work for the temple doing recruitment missions, in some cases driving as far away as Ohio, sending groups into prisons, and also integrating into the political structure by taking jobs working for politicians and at police precincts, in hospitals, and anywhere that it was believed to be potentially advantageous for Jones. The temple moved to California in 1967, and this is the period where you see Jones begin to solidify his political connections. The temple had over 3,000 members, and they voted as a block, so by concentrating members in smaller areas, Jones had the ability to influence elections. A temple PR folder that was discovered boasted letters to Jones from Ronald Reagan thanking him for a lovely bouquet of roses, as well as letters from then-President Richard Nixon and other prominent Republicans. Oh, did I not mention that? Jones and most of the temple were registered Republicans. Marxist, socialist Republicans, and fans of Richard Nixon. People are complicated animals. Jones also donated to police chief campaigns and famously sent $2,000 to the Hearst family when Patty Hearst was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army. Now, allegedly, this is when the FBI first opened a file on him. That's dubious, though. Let me explain. Jones relocated the temple to California and forged very public alliances with Huey Newton and Angela Davis, both of whom had been photographed attending temple services. By 1969, the temple was being accused of kidnapping, murder, gun running, and torture in the press, and members were negotiating with the Soviet embassy in Georgetown, but allegedly the FBI and the CIA weren't monitoring the group. The CIA allegedly took no interest in a predominantly black Marxist church of a few thousand people with ties to the Black Panther Party and the Communist Party of the United States, with plans to move out of the country while every single organization affiliated with the group itself was under surveillance. How the fuck do you explain that? I think you look at a man named Dan Mitrione, just for starters. Dan, like some other people we're going to discuss today, is mentioned by name on one of Jones's taped recordings from Jonestown. He says that he'd known Mitrione since childhood when he worked in Richmond, Indiana, which is 16 miles from Jones's hometown, where Mitrione was a police chief. Jones had started street preaching in black neighborhoods as a kid, like as young as 13, 14 years old, and he developed a relationship with Mitrione, who, let's be honest, probably used the kid for information. The early career period in Jim Jones's life, before he'd really started working on the temple, is never really covered as thoroughly as the period once the group relocated to California. But the way Jones siphoned membership from black left-leaning churches by using racist smear campaigns, and the way he dug himself into the black community like a tick, it sort of begs the question what the purpose of all of that was. Several of his biographers make note of a peculiar story told by his wife, Marceline, about a political rally that Jones attended in college. He went to Richmond University for a little while before he dropped out and decided to become a pastor. This rally was apparently about communism, and Jones reportedly didn't stay very long, and outside he spoke with a man that she believed worked for the FBI. Several months later, he dropped out of college and became a minister and preached communal Christianity. Jones also took trips to Cuba to meet Fidel Castro and to facilitate the immigration of black Cuban immigrants to the United States to work with the church. Jones, a registered Republican with Ronald Reagan as a pen pal and Angela Davis in his Rolodex, flew to Havana in February of 1960 to meet Fidel Castro, a fact not made known to the public until 4 months after the Jonestown Massacre in a piece by the New York Times. According to Carlos Foster, who was a Pentecostal minister who'd worked in Cuba, he relayed the story to the Times, a Times reporter, Tim Reiterman. Jones had showed up in Havana with $50,000, offering to pay for help recruiting Cuban families to move to Indianapolis. He spent a month in Cuba on a recruitment mission, and an interesting aspect of the account of Jones in Cuba, by the way, he didn't speak a fucking lick of Spanish, nor did his primary contact, Carlos, speak English until he immigrated to the States later on to meet up with Jones. This suggests that Jones had an interpreter that isn't mentioned in Foster's accounts of 12 to 13 hour long discussions with Jim Jones about recruitment. When Jones returned from the trip, he showed temple members a picture of himself with Fidel Castro, which he also carried and showed to people on a similar mission to Brazil in 1962. Oh, Jones's visit to Cuba and the hotel he was staying in, the Hilton Hotel in Havana, the one he was in for a month, coincides with the Soviet Union's deputy premier, Anastas Mikoyan's visit to Havana during negotiations of a low-interest loan in exchange for 1 million tons of sugar. The Havana Hilton, both Jones and the Soviet premier were staying in, was the location of an operation being overseen by the FBI, the CIA, the DGI, the KGB, and the GRU. So, circumstantially, there's like no fucking way that this is a coincidence, nor is it coincidental that a guy who didn't speak Spanish spent a month in Cuba with $50,000 and an interpreter that no one seems to remember. The State Department issued Jim Jones a passport in June of 1960 and approved his travel to Poland, Finland, the USSR, and England for sightseeing. And that's Jim's first recorded passport, issued in June. You'll note his recorded trip to Cuba was in February, before he had a passport. And he'd also represented himself to Carlos Foster as returning to Latin America at the time of his visit to Havana. So, how did a guy without a passport, who didn't speak Spanish, get into Cuba with $50,000? To keep the threads handy, at the time that Jones was approved for a passport by the State Department, Dan Mitrione was in the process of transferring to a position at the State Department to begin working in the International Cooperation Administration, an organization that sends non-military aid to countries experiencing conflict or refugee crisis. To read between the lines, the ICA funded things like tiger cages in Vietnam and trained foreign police forces in torture methods. After completing the FBI's National Academy in 1957, Mitrione was sent to Rio de Janeiro to learn Portuguese, and then to Belo Horizonte in Brazil, where his family lived for a while. Mitrione maintained the CIA's file on Jones until he was kidnapped by Tupamaro guerrillas in Uruguay in 1970 and then assassinated. Upon his death, Jim Jones's file with the CIA was purged. And so by the time of the massacre, 8 years later, the CIA would claim to have almost no prior knowledge about Jones or the temple. Curious. In 1970, the church expanded into San Francisco and Los Angeles, which Jones would dub the Mother Church in 1972, drawing membership from Watts and Compton, and continuing to focus recruitment efforts in black neighborhoods by chartering Greyhound buses into Los Angeles, and eventually across the country, bringing back members from D.C. and New York City, as well as Houston, Detroit, and Cleveland. At its height, the church was making nearly $40,000 a week in donations, much of which was funneled back into PR and donations to politicians and a record label, Brotherhood Records, which released music by Temple members, which was bought in 1973. Some of that music's actually not bad. Money was also donated to newspapers to keep negative press to a minimum. In 1976, Jones began to acknowledge his atheism semi-publicly. This is, of course, after the meth, but Jones started taking painkillers around the time that the temple moved to California, and by 1971, he was on a fairly steady diet of speed, Quaaludes, and pentobarbital, hence the sunglasses. His son actually recounts a story where he intentionally overdosed on Quaaludes to avoid having to go to church. That anyone who grew up having to go to church is probably laughing about darkly right now. Jones also used tranquilizers on members of the temple on multiple occasions, maintained an isolation tank where people were sedated and then kept in solitary confinement at Jonestown, and an entire warehouse full of drugs was discovered in Jonestown after the massacre. One of his biographers notes that drugs were never difficult for Jones to get a hand on, and it's often assumed that paranoia from drug use set off the events in Guyana, and, you know, maybe. One wonders how a warehouse full of drugs shows up anywhere in South America and the CIA isn't involved, but I'm not done with the conspiracy theories just yet. After his amphetamine habit became somewhat noticeable, Jones started telling people that the FBI and the CIA were monitoring him and had tapped all of his phones and the phones at all of his churches. He said that there were undercover spies in the congregation and everybody was being watched. And, you know, probably. Towards the end of the temple's time in California, Jones boasted political affiliation and photographs with Harvey Milk, Walter Mondale, Rosalind Carter, George Moscone, the mayor of San Francisco, who also made Jim Jones the chairman of the San Francisco Housing Authority Commission, the California governor, Jerry Brown, and many other people, including J. Edgar Hoover, actually, who supported Jones publicly amidst mounting allegations in the press and the move to Guyana. Okay, so let's talk about Jonestown. The numbers have never actually added up, literally. Final reports are 909 people died of mass suicide. That's actually the people executed at the airstrip in Port Kaituma and the Jonestown site itself. Press reports prior to the incident report 1,100 occupants, 300 of them children. Reporting the day of the massacre said 400 die in mass suicide, 700 flee into jungle. The body count performed the first day by the Guyanese yielded a total of 408. The U.S. military reported 913 a week later. This discrepancy was explained by the U.S. military as, quote, these people can't count. Later, that was amended to suggest that the 408 adults were laying on top of 505 children. Only 82 children were identified by the Guyanese, and aerial and close-up photography shows no piles of bodies. In the jungle, doing training exercises, were 600 members of the British Black Watch and a barracks of the Green Berets. So 700 people fled into the jungle, and a week later, the death toll at Jonestown was reportedly 505 bodies higher than initial reporting because brown people can't count, and not because there were two military kill squads doing drills in the jungle less than 100 miles away. The Guyanese were also skeptical of the American press's Kool-Aid suicide cult story. None of the victims at Jonestown showed evidence of cyanide poisoning, or what's known as cyanide rictus, which is the muscle spasms and contortions caused by cyanide's blockage of the central nervous system. Guyanese pathologist Leslie Mutu instead recorded injection punctures at the back of the left shoulder blades of 80% of the victims. Others were shot or strangled, and Jones himself had died by a gunshot wound to the head, a suicide that somehow dropped the gun nearly 200 feet away from his fucking body. The Guyanese reports conclude only two suicides actually occurred at Jonestown. The rest were deemed, quote, mass murder by persons unknown. Also notable for a mass poisoning, no autopsies were ever conducted by the U.S. military due to, according to U.S. Army spokesman Lieutenant Colonel Schuller, quote, the cause of death was apparent, end quote. The killers at the airstrip were described by survivors and witnesses as moving mechanically and in formation. You know, like a kill squad or something. Let me back up, though. After reports began that people were being kept at Jonestown against their will, Leo Ryan, who was a congressman from California, attempted to schedule a trip to Jonestown to evaluate the commune and make sure that Jones wasn't torturing people. He was, but they didn't know that for sure yet. Ryan was a friend of Bob Houston, a former Temple member who'd been found dead after discussing leaving the group with his ex-wife. Ryan was repeatedly blocked by the State Department in any attempt to look into what was happening in Guyana under the auspices that U.S. involvement would reflect negatively on Guyanese diplomatic relations. Ryan ultimately went around the State Department and organized the trip himself. He orchestrated the trip with a man named Richard Dwyer. Richard Dwyer was the deputy chief of mission at Georgetown, in Guyana's American embassy. Dwyer accompanied the Ryan delegation to Jonestown and was actually wounded in the gunfight at the Kaituma airstrip. He's also mentioned by name by Jones on the infamous final tape. Quote, "Take Dwyer on down to the East House, get Dwyer out of here before something happens to him," end quote, can be heard by Jones on the tape containing the massacre at the compound. Letters from People's Temple members Tim Carter and Sharon Layton identify Richard Dwyer as working in a representative capacity for the CIA, and that he liaised regularly with Jones as such. There's also never been an explanation for Dwyer's account that he was present at the airstrip while also being mentioned by name on the tape at the compound, either. Oh, the last tape. There's a bit about the last tape. Q04, which is referred to commonly as the final tape, the tape that contains the actual mass execution of the Jonestown People's Temple members, isn't actually the last tape. Q875, a recording from the Jonestown compound, is actually the final tape. And the issue with Q875 is that when cross-checked with radio broadcasts playing in the background on the tape, Q875 was recorded after everybody died. And there's never been an explanation for who recorded a tape in a compound full of dead people. Survivors, Stanley Clayton and two attorneys for the temple who were on site, also reported hearing machine gun fire as they escaped into the jungle. And while he's a dubious source, former Green Beret Bo Gritz has claimed the presence of the Green Berets near Jonestown was to execute the people at the compound. Again, Bo Gritz is an unreliable fucking source, so do with that what you will. And finally, there's the White Savior Suicide Cult cover story for Jonestown. I bet you didn't know that's not the first time a white guy took a group of black people into the Guyanese jungle to commit mass suicide, did you? In 1843, there was a native named Awakapu who learned English and worked for German merchants. He amassed 1,000 followers, promising to teach them what he'd learned from his time with the white men. He then built a settlement called Bekaranta, which roughly translates to Land of the White People. The guy lived in a two-story harem, lived with a harem in a two-story building, and carried himself like a mystic and demanded obedience, encouraging the drinking of Kasiri liquid, which is a toxic mild hallucinogen that lowers your inhibitions. Awakapu told the natives in the settlement that they would be reborn with white skin if they killed each other. 400 of them died there, some 200 miles from the site of Jonestown, and after nobody resurrected, Awakapu was clubbed to death. So it's interesting, in fact, to note that this somewhat irrational story used to explain how 900 people died in the jungle, less than 100 miles away from a government kill team, that the exact same thing happened not far away a century before that. And perhaps that may be playing off of the superstitions of the natives. Who knows? But it's noteworthy that Jonestown was not the first predominantly black mass suicide to take place in the jungle outside Georgetown. So, at end of event, a group that was 70% black, half of whom were women over the age of 60, were dead in the jungle. And back in the U.S., a lot was made of Jones's ties to socialist and leftist groups and his prominence in the black community. Similar drugs would be used to destroy Huey Newton shortly thereafter in the American government's continuous war on the black left. Comparisons, of course, between Jim Jones and Charles Manson were quickly presented by a voracious American media, quick to report the military's account of the event. Most families never received their loved ones' remains. They were informed that due to advanced decomposition, they would be unidentifiable and impossible to transport. 400 of them were eventually buried in a mass grave at Evergreen Cemetery in Oakland, California. Some 215 people remain unaccounted for. Jones's tapes, all 975 of them, haven't yet been fully analyzed. Survivors of Jonestown, Jeannie and Al Mills, were later murdered in their home, found bound and gagged. Mayor Moscone was shot and killed in his office a few days after the Jonestown massacre took place. Sensitive FBI documents were actually recovered from the scene at Jonestown, and that's raised a few eyebrows, as you would imagine. Among the documents was a list of informants, a copy of which was held by Temple attorney Charles Gary, one of the survivors who reported hearing machine gun fire in the jungle that I mentioned earlier. The documents were part of a book being written by a former FBI agent who could not explain what pages of his work were doing in South America, as they allegedly had nothing to do with the People's Temple. His attorney believes members of the Temple may have raided his office and taken a file on him with them to Guyana. Or there's been a history of the FBI and the CIA in proximity to Jim Jones, literally his entire fucking life, that somehow neither organization has record of. Jim fucking Jones is probably the only communist in the history of the 1960s that wasn't under government surveillance. There's also something dubious about the quickness with which the government threw around the term brainwashing. From its first use in the Miami Daily News in 1950, brainwashing was associated with communism by the American press. Its first use ever was, quote, "Brainwashing tactics force Chinese into ranks of Communist Party," end quote. Brainwashing, according to reporter Ed Hunter, was an ancient Chinese technique, Xi Nao, literally wash brain in Mandarin. Brainwashing came up again during the Korean War, when American POWs began confessing to war atrocities committed against Korean citizens. The military alleged that was the result of communist brainwashing. Fuck, by 1980, even the American Psychiatric Association recognized brainwashing as a form of dissociative disorder in the DSM-3. Incidentally, Ed Hunter, Vanguard Miami journalist, CIA agent in the propaganda wing, who wove a story of mystical Orientalist Red Scare bullshit that became part of the zeitgeist due to the state's bedfellows, Hollywood, and the news media. Ultimately, brainwashing is just conditioning, usually through torture. forcing a person to confess embarrassing facts about themselves, forced isolation, what's called milieu control or control over an individual's surroundings, and things like sleep and food deprivation. B.F. Skinner has said maybe too much about human conditioning, to be perfectly honest. And through this idea created by the United States government, the Chinese had this ancient oriental technique to wash minds or whatever the fuck, Stalin got the idea to release a telegram that could be intercepted accidentally that said they'd figured it out. And 3 years later, you had millions of dollars being funded into the MK Ultra program by the CIA's director, Alan Dulles, who I promise we're going to do an episode about here in the very near future. But pursuant from that brainwashing MK Ultra CIA intelligence community bullshit, we had people like Ted Kaczynski, we had Charles Manson, who I wholeheartedly believe was a CIA plant, and here we have another one in Jim Jones, who is over and over and over again throughout his history in proximity to CIA operatives, FBI operatives, FBI operations, and surrounded by people of his own volition who we know were being surveyed by the United States government. You cannot tell me, honestly, that a white guy running a communist church with a 70% black membership who was friends with Angela Davis, Huey Newton, and Harvey fucking Milk wasn't being watched by the FBI. And the only explanation, the only obvious explanation for why the FBI or the CIA wouldn't have been observing a white man with a communist church with a 70% black membership who was friends with Angela Davis, Huey Newton, and Harvey fucking Milk was if they put him there. And when the Jonestown Massacre took place, wouldn't you know who won the fucking pony? The federal government all of a sudden has an example of communist brainwashing resulting in the deaths of several hundred African Americans in a country that just happens to be war-torn by Marxists versus CIA-backed military junta. But I'll get to that in a minute. So there's quite a lot that can be said about the relationship that Jim Jones and the actions at Jonestown had to the image of left-wing, predominantly black communism, and, well, qui bono. An interesting bit about Jones and the brain, by the way. Jim Jones had received some psychiatric treatment at the Langley Porter Neuropsychiatric Institute in San Francisco during the 1960s and 70s. His medical files remain sealed even after his death. Langley Porter has worked with DARPA and experimented extensively with electromagnetic effects on behavioral modification techniques. Are you ready to get weird with me, cadets? DARPA was using Langley Porter to study things like hypnosis at a distance. Dr. Alan Gevins, director of the Institute, noted the enormous potential of extremely low frequency radiation, or ELF waves. ELF waves transmit communications between submarines. They're thousands of miles long, unobstructed by water, and theoretically capable of shutting off the human brain. According to Gevins, the levels of ELF waves are so low, the brain could mistake the outside signal for its own, mimic it, which is a process known as bioelectric entrainment, and respond when the signal changes. Due to a study authorized by the mayor of San Francisco before his assassination, 9 days after the Jonestown Massacre, every survivor of Jonestown was treated at Langley Porter, who were ostensibly studying brainwashing techniques. I'm also ignoring the political environment in Guyana. The dominant political party at the time was the People's Progressive Party, the PPP, led by Chetty Jagan. The PPP were a Marxist revolutionary organization who had overthrown British colonial control of the region in the 1940s. As a result, Britain had declared a crisis situation in Guyana in 1953 and deployed troops such as the aforementioned Black Watch, and Britain declared the Guyanese constitution was suspended and the recent election had been nullified to prevent communist subversion. There was effectively a police state operating Guyana run by MI6 and the CIA for the following 4 years. The PPP then split, with Jagan maintaining leadership of the main group, and a man named Forbes Burnham, a proponent of a Guyanese form of Black Hebrew Israelism, opposing him in an upcoming election. Jagan won the election in 1961, sparking CIA and MI6-backed attacks by Burnham's splinter sect against the PPP. Racial and economic tensions were exacerbated by propaganda campaigns funded by the CIA and the American Institute for Free Labor, which was also used as a cover for operations against local trade unions. Eventually, Jagan was ousted and Burnham was installed to power, very much a puppet regime for the CIA and MI6, one that would approve the Jones Project and lease the land for the compound. Records note, curiously, that Jones's message to the locals in Georgetown was uncharacteristically anti-communist, warning about white Western missionaries because they bring communism with them. The irony is fucking palpable, to be sure. And Jones, in many other aspects, continued to be surrounded by CIA operatives his entire goddamn life. His contact with the U.S. consulate in setting up the Jonestown Project, John Ladison, was a CIA agent who taught at the U.S. Intelligence School in Partenkirchen, in West Germany, and he was kicked out of the Soviet Union for espionage before taking a job at Radio Liberty, the CIA propaganda network, before being moved to South America in the 1960s. And whenever Jones lived in Brazil, he worked for Invesco, a CIA front organization that worked on a commission-only basis, so there never had to be record that he showed up at work while he was doing whatever the fuck else he was actually doing in South America. Invesco, by the way, is also tied to Despina through Otto Skorzeny, who was an officer for Adolf Hitler and sold arms after the war out of Algiers. It's just a big connect, the fascist business connection thing, and Jim Jones is very much tied directly into and plugged into that thing. And it's just when you start to look at all of the things that are the accepted aspects of the story, for example, this idea that this guy convinced 900 people to drink cyanide out of a vat because it would somehow bring them to the promised land to embrace revolutionary socialism. It's almost like a guy listened to the White Album and that convinced him to start a race war by getting a whole bunch of college dropouts to take acid and murder a Hollywood starlet. Sometimes it's like impressive how well they do with the clandestine stuff, and then they're so very, very bad at coming up with the cover story after the fact. They very rarely make any fucking sense. So what do I think happened here? I think that a man forged a relationship with someone who was recruited by the CIA very young. That man had something of a tendency towards sociopathy, if his medical records are to be believed. And the CIA used that man and directed him into black, left, and communist circles to accumulate followers and then fleece them for money. And then whenever he had accumulated a large enough following, that man was aimed at politicians and social leaders. And he was, in much the same way Charles Manson was, deposited into California in the 1960s, where he could hobnob with communist revolutionaries, black radicals, wannabe politicians, Ronald fucking Reagan, and lots of other influential people to establish a network to gather information from. And whenever his ability to gather information was finally hindered by the coverage of the press about the violent, manipulative, and abusive things he was doing to the black members of his congregation, he fled to South America with the assistance of the CIA, set up a compound that was overseen by the CIA, used mind manipulation tactics he probably learned from the CIA to traumatize and condition the 1,100 people, 215 of which were never relocated after the fact, by the way, people who followed him down there. And whenever it suited the purposes of the CIA to have this black socialist organization collapse in on itself under the weight of the cult of personality of the person that they had put in charge of it, they facilitated a mass execution and then shot him in the fucking head. That's what I think happened at Jonestown. I think there's a sufficient amount of evidence that bears that out. I don't really believe the accepted narrative, but then again, it's fair to say that I rarely, if ever, do. And I think that ultimately, the victims of this mass execution aimed at the political left by the federal government and the intelligence community were black people. Because, like I said, 70% of the victims were black and 50% of those were women over the age of 60. So, just like everything else in this country, the predominant cannon fodder ends up being black people and even more so black women. And the fallout is apparent. The establishment of anti-cult groups focused on the dangers of cult programming and brainwashing. Again, something invented by a CIA propagandist that never really existed, that was founded in conceptualized Chinese racism. So this demonization of the scary communist cult leader, cult of personality figure, the susceptibility of black people to be led by a secret communist to do things that are against their own best interests, something that's been used as a talking point by the right wing ever since, and of course the proximity to the politicians that he formulated relationships with who were damaged in their reputation as a result of their proximity to this guy who killed 900 people or 400 people or however many people you think he was directly responsible for the deaths of. I guess we could argue that because he's the reason they were all there, he was responsible for all of them, but you make up your own mind on that one. So that's what I have to say about Jim Jones, the CIA, and what I think really happened at Jonestown. That's been my own little conspiracy. I hope you enjoyed. Is always the wrong, it always feels like the wrong word to use in wrapping these up. I hope you got something out of this. Maybe? I don't know. Anyway, if you did enjoy this and you found yourself becoming a fan of these little Fireside Chats, and you'd like to become a member of the illustrious and ever-growing Hep Cult, you can do so by going to www.patreon.com/comeandseepod. There's a few different options available for you there as far as pay tiers, but for as little as $5 a month, you can support the show and help me pay bills and things of that nature. And all subscribers to the podcast through the Patreon page get a download link to the Uncle Bill mixtape, which you've heard if you've listened to a few of the episodes this season. You've heard, I think, 3 of the songs that are featured on that tape. There's 10 in all, but it's a cool little mixtape that I just made as a thank you for the fans, just in the off season between seasons 3 and 4. And if you become a Patreon subscriber, you'll get that thing. Also, if you would like to drink and or wear your support for the Come and See podcast, you can do so by going to comeandseemerch.bigcartel.com, and there you'll be able to pick up a bag of our coffee collaboration with Black Forge Coffee Company, Behold a Dark Roast, which is free trade coffee. It tastes fantastic. We ship Black Forge Coffee Company, and as such, would recommend you go pick up a bag of that. And also, there's the Come and See t-shirt, which is about to ship out, I fucking promise. As soon as those get to me, I'll be shipping them out to you, so they'll be here soon. And as I've said, I'm working on a design for a nude shirt, possibly a hoodie, for, I think I'm going to shoot for 420 for the launch for the new shirt design. I've been toying with something for a front and back piece with sleeve prints, something fresh for all the cadets, cats and kittens who want to, I guess, wear a hoodie in April. Then again, you never know what the fuck the weather's going to do these days, do you? It's been all 4 seasons in the last 7 days. I think it's going to rain frogs later, but I'm not actually sure. But at any rate, we'll be back. Same Mox time, same Mox channel. On the next episode of Come and See, we're going to discuss serial killers and the Manchurian Candidate. We're going to keep this weird CIA conspiracy shit going. I'm feeling the vibes. So we're going to keep this running for the rest of the week, I think. And that'll give us an opportunity to talk a little bit more about brainwashing, maybe a bit about MKUltra, although I feel like some of that would be retread at this point, so we'll see. But you'll just have to see what direction we're going to take things on the next episode of the show. But in the meantime, concentrate on the Hep, everybody. I have been Moxie O'Brien. This has been Come and See. And I will catch all of you Hep cats on the flip side. Smooches, deuces, dig it.
This is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa. For all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white. Jesus was a white man too, but you know, it's like, he was a historical figure. I mean, that's a verifiable fact, as is Santa.
Finished.